So, Mayo, I'm coming to you from a remote Airbnb like 30 minutes outside of Waco because we're in the moving process and our house is empty. We were talking before the show and there are a number of things that could go very wrong with this recording. I am talking to you via a Moxie, M-O-X-E-E, portable hotspot, which is the quote-unquote router for this Airbnb. The desk that my laptop is sitting on wobbles back and forth very, very severely, so it could collapse at any point. The room was an echo chamber. I hung up a bunch of blankets, put some pillows on the floor all around me, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, you sound all right, to be fair.
I think I do sound okay. I didn't have a microphone stand until yesterday. So if you listen to 9 to 5 Mac Daily on Monday or Tuesday, it was me holding the microphone like a comedian or something, just sitting here in my office or sitting here in the Airbnb.
What idiot would have to hold a microphone for an entire episode?
That gets me to our next problem. So I thought I was going to have the most trouble recording this episode, you know, being out in the wilderness with the animals. And then we're on video before we start recording. And what happens to you, Mayo?
The end bit of the microphone just flops forward for the end reasons bit. Unclear. Yeah, because I have the mic on an arm. The arm's fine. It's like the bit that like adapts the end of the microphone that plugs into the bit on the arm. Like I have a Rode Podcaster mic. It's the final little bit on the end that just makes it stick out.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, that has just now, about a minute before we start recording, decided to completely fail. And no matter how much you tighten it, it just flops forward. So...
literally, if I let go, a minute.
It literally just falls into my lap, which would not be very good for the audio direction. The arm will keep it hanging there, but it'll be facing the wrong direction. So, in lieu of any other solution that I can't think of with 1 minute to record time, I'm just holding it for the whole episode.
So, your arm is going to be infinitely stronger by the end of this.
I'm building muscle mass as I speak. Yeah. My like forcep muscle is going to pop off soon. I can't even like rest my elbow on the table because of where the mic is, so it's free hanging in the air. So maybe when we do an ad break or something, I'll like switch arms, but
yeah,
we'll see how it goes, because I can also feel the blood disappearing from my hand. But we'll survive.
Well, before all of that happens, we should probably, I guess, get to the news.
Yeah, get the news out of the way, then I can worry about my blood flow.
iOS 17.5 is here. We've talked about the beta quite a bit over the past few weeks. There are a couple of things, though, that I don't think we talked about. I don't think we knew about until...
yeah, a couple of surprises. Yeah.
This week. So the first one is Apple News Plus offline mode. So if you're an Apple News Plus subscriber, you can now enable offline mode to auto-download top stories, Apple News Today audio briefings, magazine issues, and narrated articles. So they'll download and you can listen to them or read them without Wi-Fi or cellular. Then when your device is back online, more content will be downloaded, and Apple says it has some optimizations in place to make sure you don't end up with 512 gigabytes of Apple News Plus content on your phone. This seems cool, nothing revolutionary. It's kind of like, I don't know how useful old news is to read. I guess old magazines could be good to read.
Well, I think it like periodically updates in the background or whatnot, right?
So Yeah.
Like a lot of these smart features, there isn't really much control over what it's downloading, when it's downloading, and how much it downloads. So if you are doing this thing, you kind of have to trust the gods, I guess, of News Plus, so that, let's say you're going on an airplane with you don't have any data for the flight, that when you open your phone or your iPad, it will actually have stuff that's relatively new to read. If it works, it's a good idea. And like I just said, the optimized storage button also doesn't give you much control. It's just an on or off switch. So who knows how many gigabytes of data it'll decide to take up. Like that's one, you know, like iOS 18 is obviously going to have all this AI stuff, but Gurman keeps saying it's going to just be like a big update overall.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if everywhere, like every Apple app that has an optimized storage button, it just lets you pick like only use 10 gigabytes max and never use any touch more. Because if you get low on storage space, like if you have a high capacity phone, it doesn't really matter too much. They can, you know, the policies can be really lax. But if you are actually needing the space, i.e. that's maybe when you'd want to be turning on optimized storage, being able to set like gigabyte limits would be really handy, because the smart systems are just never smart enough. Like photos, optimized storage, you put optimized storage on and then you want to download something, like you want to download a movie just before you're going on a trip. How on earth are you meant to make it like clear all the data away so it'll actually download the film? Like, it's really hard to do. So I would hope that some kind of like upgrade to the optimized storage algorithm globally is in progress. But as it is now, the news app just acts like every other Apple app that has optimized storage. You can turn optimized storage on, and then you just have to hope that it does what you want it to do. But at least in theory, this is a nice feature. I mean, I browse news sometimes.
And if it's only for Apple News Plus subscribers, though, so that's kind of a key limitation.
I get Apple One, so we get through that. It's a nice feature. I'll take it. A bit out of the blue, a bit random, but I'll probably use it at some point in the future. It's one of those features where you completely forget that it even exists, and then one day you'll like click on the news app and be like, oh, that article loaded. So I'll take it.
We also have a new Find My Network upgrade type thing. Apple's worked with Google so that any user, regardless of whether they use iPhone or Android, will get an alert on their device if an unknown Bluetooth tracking device is seen moving with them over time. Even if that Bluetooth tracker is paired with an iPhone or an Android, every user will get the notification. And my interpretation of this is that on Android, it's specifically important for AirTags because right now, Apple has the app on Android that lets you scan around you for nearby unwanted AirTags, but it doesn't proactively work in the background.
Yeah, you have to open the app every time.
Yeah, so I think this is like a dramatic upgrade from that experience for Android users in particular.
Yeah, and this was something that it was obviously going around when the privacy concerns about AirTags were a thing, when AirTags launched. Apple did do some little improvements, right? And then they released, like when they first released AirTags, they didn't even release an Android app at all, right? The Android app came later in the year. And then when it did come out, called like Apple Tracker Detect or whatever, you have to like practically scan, which is kind of stupid because you don't know you're being tracked until like how you what you're meant to do every day, just bring out this app and press the button. There are some third-party apps you can buy that do Bluetooth scan in the background for this stuff, but like you want the Apple, you know, you want like the first-party solution for something like this. But then in early 2023, Apple and Google officially announced a partnership to make like an industry specification for unwanted tracking detection of these like Bluetooth trackers, like AirTags and everything else. And it's finally shipping about a year later. So if you have an Android phone, you're up to date, it can find an AirTag that's moving with you. It's basically the exact same thing on the iPhone where you get like the AirTag moving with you or unknown device moving with you alerts, whether it's AirPods or AirTags or anything, but you get that on Android. And if there are other, other non-AirTag but AirTag-like products that are relatively popular that also support this standard, it will also work the other way around. So your iPhone will be able to flag to you that these things are following you, not just the Apple products. So it's a nice step. This probably should have been put in motion more proactively.
All the AirTag safety features is Apple was kind of reactive in adding them. They launched with more features than offered by like Tile, but still not enough. And we've seen them ever since AirTag came out in 2021? Mm-hmm. There's been like a steady stream of new safety features coming.
Yeah, because they like pushed like they were thinking about safety when they launched it, but there were some clear holes, especially like what do you do for half the population who have an Android device, right? And they didn't even have an app when they first launched. That was like terrible. They probably should have been ready or like had conversations with Google back then about having some universal standard, because the actual way that AirTags work with the Bluetooth identification and nearby stuff is not too dissimilar from the from the exposure notifications stuff that they did for COVID, right? Which was an Apple and Google partnership.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't have been too much of a leap to say, well, we're going to also bring this technology to, you know, item trackers. But for whatever reason, Apple didn't. And then it's taken them a while, but now we're at a point where this is basically what should have been here from the beginning. But I'm happy they finally, you know, come to an agreement and it's available.
Speaking of AirTags, so we loaded up our moving truck yesterday, or rather paid people to load up the moving truck yesterday, but I got the idea to put an AirTag in one of the boxes so we can like watch the truck move across the country. And then I had a thought as I was doing that. I thought, well, people are going to be driving this truck. Are they going to be getting like AirTag found moving with you notifications on their iPhone the whole time?
Yep.
And I said, is that like a problem? I don't want to be rude. I don't want to be creepy. So I Googled and I was like, should I put an AirTag in my moving truck? And their resounding answer was yes. And there were comments on like Reddit from people who drive these moving trucks for a living. And they say, yeah, we get the notifications all the time. It's fine. We know you're just watching your stuff and it's no big deal. So I said, okay. So I took an AirTag that I had no use for, renamed it to Moving Truck and tossed it in a box. So now I'll get to watch it move across the country.
But yeah, we'll start beeping. Yeah. Like, give it 24 hours. Surely they won't be able
to hear the
beeping. Give it like 24 hours, or I think it's between what, 24 and 72, something like that. It'll start notifying everybody nearby and it'll start beeping itself. It'll make a noise. So that was funny. Like, when this isn't the logic behind what I'm about to say is no different to when their tags launch, except it now applies to Android users as well as Apple users. But like, if someone steals your item, your Android phone will also be like, yeah, there's something moving with you. Like, if people put air tags on their bike and your bike gets stolen, even more people now will know that you're tracking it, right?
Yeah.
And Apple's never promoted AirTags as an anti-theft device. They're meant for just when things get lost, you know, innocently. But a lot of people do use them for anti-theft scenarios. And the privacy alert stuff, the fan moving with you alerts, obviously make that far less useful for that use case. So that's why they're not advertised as anti-theft devices. But a lot of people do it anyway.
We see a lot of stories of AirTags being used to find stolen cars. That's for sure.
Yeah, they're pretty effective, apart from the privacy stuff. And if you go on like some less legitimate websites, there are people who explain how you can take an AirTag and modify it to make it not beep and do all this stuff that gets around some of that things. But don't be creepy.
Also in 17.5, there is a new set of Pride wallpapers ahead of Pride Month in June. We also have a new Pride watch face in watchOS 10.5. And a new Apple Watch Pride Edition braided solo loop. Apple says that all of this is part of their effort to support the LGBTQ+ communities. Portions of the proceeds are donated to organizations that help do that. Kind of an annual tradition at this point, but it's always good to see. The wallpapers this year, I think, are pretty cool. They're sort of like 80s retro inspired. Mm-hmm. So I like them. The watch band is also very nice looking, very colorful. Looks good.
Yeah, I like them. I love it. I wish Apple would do more wallpapers and stuff in general. Like, they have the system now where they're all dynamic, you know, whether it's Pride or anything. Just give me more of them. I switch between them. Same with watch faces. They can never have enough watch faces and they only add like a couple a year. The Pride watch face this year is like, it's digital time. And as you move your wrist around, it like uses the accelerometer or the gyroscope to like move the beams of light around in like concert with it. It's a bit in your face for day-to-day watch usage, in my opinion. So maybe it's something people do for like this month and they give up on, or, you know, they go back to another face. Or if you do like it, you can use it, of course. But I use the California face with the, I can't remember if they brand it Pride, but like the rainbow theme. So like,
yeah.
It's just like a gradient of all the rainbow colors. I use that one quite a lot. So that's in my like normal rotation of watch faces. Yeah, go for it. If people like these faces, go for it. I wish they just more. I wish they do like a watch face or a wallpaper like every other month. Like,
yeah,
it should be way more frequent than what it actually is. Happy Hour this week is sponsored by Incogni. Get an exclusive 60% discount at incogni.com/happyhour. You might not know that there are hundreds of commercial databases and people search sites that hold your personal information. They aggregate data like you, like your name and your aliases, your social security number, your home address, online activity, and more. All of this is made available for purchase by businesses and could fall into the hands of criminals. In a nutshell, your personal information is being sold or published online without you even knowing about it. And you have the legal right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete this information that they hold about you, but the bad news is that actually doing that would take you ages. To do it manually, it's just not feasible. And that's only once. You have to keep repeating the process every few months as new data brokers continue collecting data and creating new records about you. So Incogni is the solution. They do all of the work on your behalf. You sign up, you tell them what personal data you want removing, and you let them handle it. They contact data brokers on your behalf to request your data is removed. They deal with any objections, keep you updated, and they keep protecting your data privacy for as long as you use the service. So sign up and they maintain your data privacy. It's so convenient. So check them out right now at incogni.com/happyhour and get an exclusive 60% off your annual Incogni plan with promo code happyhour. That's spelled incogni.com/happyhour, promo code happyhour. Thanks to Incogni for sponsoring the show.
So looking beyond iOS 17.5, Apple has previewed its next set of accessibility features coming to iOS 18. As usual, they don't explicitly say that they're coming to iOS 18. They say later this year. But this is an annual tradition at this point in honor of Global Accessibility Awareness Day, where Apple kind of previews what's next for accessibility on its platforms. The headlining feature this year is eye tracking. So this is a way for... it's an accessibility feature that lets you control your iPhone or your iPad with your eyes. It works just like it sounds, so you can watch a cursor go around the screen with your eyes, and then you can, Apple calls it dwell, on a button or an icon to activate that button or icon. It's hard to explain because it kind of just works exactly how you'd expect it to work. It's in some ways similar to the navigation interface on Vision Pro. Apple has a video in its press release showing how it works, but...
yeah, basically, it uses... you know, like, when you do voiceover, and you have to... it basically puts up those, like, selection boxes on the screen, and normally you have to, like, drag your finger around, or you can, like, swipe your finger to navigate through the interface, and then you, like, double-click the screen to select something. It's kind of like that, but the point is it's meant for people who can't use their hands very well, right? So the idea is you can just look, and those selection boxes will appear where you're looking... and then you just kind of like hold your gaze and it counts that as the selection action. I don't know whether it supports like more complicated actions like, you know, dragging and sliding, or like, you know, like, is it more in the video? They just show it as like look and select. So we'll see how detailed you can get. But any support on this feature is a great, great advancement, and obviously kind of builds off some of the learnings they did on Vision OS. It's not going to be as precise as what you get on the Vision Pro, because that has like, you know, eye tracking cameras staring directly at your pupils.
Right.
This has got like one front facing camera, and they're using like, I think they even call it artificial intelligence in the press release. They're just kind of looking at where you're looking, and it's going to be a lot more coarse and rough and approximate, and the selection box is going to be quite big. So if you've got a lot of small controls, you probably won't be able to use it very well. But, you know, if you need it, and something is better than nothing, and you might be able to combine it with other input methods, other assistive input methods. So like, you can do eye tracking, but if you're in a specific app and you need additional help, you can use, you know, voice control or some of the other features they already have in the system. This is just one more option, and it's really cool.
And just from a personal perspective, when my mom had ALS, or got diagnosed with ALS in 2022. There's a company called Tobii Dynavox that makes, it's called the TD Pilot, I think it's called. It's like an add-on accessory slash case style thing that attaches to an iPad that brings eye control to an iPad through like Apple's Made for iPad MFI program. And it's incredible hardware, but the problem that we had and that lots of other people have is it's expensive. The price of that thing without insurance was over $10,000. So when my mom with ALS, she lost her ability to move her hands or use her hands at all. So she needed a way to control her iPad. So we applied through insurance to get the TD Pilot thing. Denied, denied, denied. Took months to actually get approved through insurance to get it. And then probably at least another month for it to actually like arrive. And at that point, she basically, I just don't think she had any interest in learning how to use something new. If she had had eye tracking built into iPadOS, she probably could have and wanted to learn how to use it. But with the 4, 5, 6 months that it took to actually get the TD Pilot thing, she had just lost interest. Like, she wasn't willing to take on the mental load to learn something new.
Yeah, exactly. So when it's built in, you know, as soon as you're diagnosed with conditions like that, you can start introducing
these
additional assistive features. Like, you know, people that are turning blind can learn how to use VoiceOver in advance instead of having to worry about having to pay to buy some additional, you know, device or hardware, or, you know, worry about medical insurance if you're in America and stuff like that. So, yeah, having it built in, even if it's not like, obviously the eye tracking powered by the front facing camera is not going to be as high quality as the thing that costs you 10 grand, right? And it has all those you know, extra sensors and stuff, but anything is better than nothing. And if it works decently enough, it can even, you know, you might even have people who have the special equipment, but they, you know, if it depends on your circumstance, right? But you might be able to get away with just using the system thing where you don't need any extra hardware on you for day-to-day stuff. And then if you actually want to do, you know, something more complicated or work-wise or something, then you put on the extra hardware. Like,
yes, exactly.
It doesn't preclude you using other stuff or other ways of or other methods of input, but I think it's a great, it's cool.
Oh, it's wonderful, yeah.
The other thing they mentioned, they call out ALS in this press release about the dictation thing. So they're going to have more accommodations for atypical speech in terms of like Siri and dictation accuracy as well.
Which that also, because that was one of the first things about my mom that changed was her voice just got harder and harder for her to speak and her voice changed dramatically. And presumably this would help. And I guess it'll help with voice. What'll it help with? It'll help with dictation and I guess
voice recognition with Siri,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like Siri, can, yeah.
Yeah.
Another Siri thing that's coming is vocal shortcuts, where you can assign a custom action phrase to launch shortcuts. So you don't have to say the Siri wake word. You can assign it to basically any word that you'd like. And this, again, like I said, ties into the atypical speech thing that helps improve dictation and speech recognition accuracy. Music haptics is something that they announced that sounds really cool. So how this works is it's designed to help the deaf or hard of hearing enjoy music like everyone else. So it uses the iPhone haptic engine to play taps and refined vibrations that synchronize with the music being played audibly, which that just sounds really cool, like really, really cool. The iPhone haptic engine is so good.
Yeah, and I think they say it will be for Apple Music, but there'll also be an API so other music apps can do it too.
Something called for motion sickness. So if you're someone who tends to get motion sick in a car, vehicle motion cues will overlay like a pattern of animated dots that follow the direction of the vehicle's motion. So Apple's explanation is that this works because it reduces the sensory conflict in the brain. I have no idea the science behind that or what exactly that means, but as someone who gets incredibly motion sick in cars, I'm excited to try this.
Yeah, this is probably the one that's most relevant to me as well, like just because this does happen to me. I don't think anywhere near to the extent that you get it, but if I'm like a passenger in a car and they're driving down the motorway or something and I'm like looking at my phone and then you look up, sometimes it does feel a bit disorientating. I don't know the science behind the black dots moving around in the same direction as the car movement, but you know, Apple obviously has smart people, so they obviously think it helps some subset of people that are affected by that stuff. So I'll definitely try this out when it arrives as part of iOS 18 later this year.
Another thing is a new hover typing option that enlarges the current text field, improvements to Braille input, some changes to CarPlay. Like CarPlay now has sound recognition. So if you're driving and your iPhone hears sirens behind you, for example, it'll pop up on CarPlay and say, sound recognized, potentially sirens, or whatever the sound may be. Vision Pro is adding live captions. So it takes everything being spoken around you and presents it in written form in front of you on Vision Pro, all in real time. And that also ties into audio apps. So for example, if you're on a FaceTime call in Vision OS, you can see a real-time transcription in front of you of the audio from that FaceTime call, or I think it's any system audio on Vision OS.
Yeah, that is nice. I mean, obviously it depends on the quality of the transcription, right?
Yes, but yeah.
Apple's transcription algorithms are getting better and better, so.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, we'll take it for sure.
Anything else on the accessibility stuff for iOS 18?
The hover typing thing was a thing that I felt was most relevant to like my grandpa, who uses an iPhone, but you know, he's like 80 something, and he just finds it hard to type because he doesn't really know like, when you click a button, like has he actually clicked the button? Yeah. Has he clicked the key next to the button? Like his thumbs are quite big and stuff, so they kind of cover the letters. So, you know, it's not like a complicated feature. It just makes the text box show in the middle of the screen nice and big. But that's what you need sometimes, because if you're not 100% confident with typing on a touchscreen, you just need to be able to see the letters huge. And he has like, you know, the large text size stuff. So obviously, like the UI is like blown up anyway. But you know, if the keyboard doesn't change size, so you can't really see like the keys when you're typing sometimes, or he like double taps and he accidentally puts it in twice or whatever. So that's something I'll definitely get him to try when it's available for him. Just have the letters that are being typed really, really big. You know, it's just little things like that that make a huge difference. Though obviously, you know, if you're me or you, you're never going to turn on a secondary text box that just repeats the text box on the screen. But if you need it for accessibility, it can be the difference between like enjoying using the device and, you know, not being able to get done what you do at all.
Yeah, I've always had a profound respect and admiration for Apple's accessibility features. And then when my mom got sick, got ALS, it like seeing how the features are applicable in people's lives and having an appreciation for how even what was available in 2022 when she needed them, it's just great stuff. You know, Apple is leading the industry on this stuff. The personal voice feature was last year, I think, and that's proven to be incredibly impressive, incredibly powerful. Just good stuff all around. And again, this is iOS 18, presumably, so we'll get some maybe demos of it and more details at WWDC. And then,
yeah, it'll be in the betas. That's normally what happens. Yeah, so yeah. The first betas, they have all these features available for you to try out. So
then a September release. The iPad Pros, Mayo, they are here, and so are the new iPad Airs, but iPad Pros are a lot more interesting.
The iPad Air is the same, but you can also get it 13 inches.
Pretty much. And how much do you have to say about the reviews of the iPad Pro? Because I think going into the iPad Pro launch and expecting these embargoed reviews, the obvious joke that you could make was you could pre-write them because you know they're going to say the hardware is incredible, the software is
limiting.
Doesn't take full advantage of the hardware.
Yep.
And I think that's exactly what the reviews say. And I said last week, it's a very tired argument, like an argument that I don't like making. The hardware is so good, the software is not so good. But it's just true.
It's tired, but it's true, right? So exactly. It feels a bit redundant saying the same thing year after year after year. But it's not tired because it's like outdated. It's just the reality of the last of those five generations of iPad hardware.
And the other reality, too, is we say every year, it's like, maybe this is the year for iPadOS. iPadOS 18 is going to add some great multitasking features. It's really going to take full advantage of the M4 chip. I don't know. Maybe this will be the year. The thing is, you never know.
I think out of all the years, this is one least likely to have iPad-specific stuff. Because I think the software teams at Apple have just been full pelt on AI. Like, that's been the prerogative from top down.
Yeah.
I know they call it iOS and iPadOS, but it's the exact same software team that make them. And it's basically the exact same software, right, once you take off the branding. I think all of the engineers have just been pedaled to the metal doing AI stuff. So any spare bandwidth is just dedicated to making AI features, which is going to be great for the iPhone. But I don't think I don't think this is the year I expect the iPad to get too much love.
At the very least, some of those AI features will hopefully come to the iPad as well. Hopefully.
Maybe.
Hopefully.
I mean, the trend, unfortunately, is a lot of time all the new features come to the iPhone and then they come to the iPad a year after. Like, widgets is a great example, you know, the lock screen stuff. It's always delayed. Some of the iOS stuff, like maybe Safari and, you know, those kind of changes should be cross-platform, but there might be some stuff. I'd almost bet there's some cool AI thing that's iPhone exclusive that could well be on the iPad and will come later. They're just, I think they're going to struggle to even get all the AI stuff for the iPhone out in time because they've been pretty ambitious and they've been trying to catch up, right? A lot of stuff could be, it's just business. The iPhone sells so many units every single year. It's their most important product that it gets the most attention. And it'll be the same again here. We would love for the iPad to improve. It does get improvements. It's just a very slow pace of software incremental changes. You compare the capability of an iPad for productivity today versus 5 years ago, and it's way better. There's a long way to go before it reaches the full potential of what it could be. You have a MacBook that's even an M2 chip and it will outstrip the iPad with M4 just on raw productivity because macOS is so much more capable in so many different ways.
So Mayo, you didn't buy an iPad Pro. I have not yet bought an iPad Pro, but you did have some time to go hands-on with it. I think you said your brother got the 13-inch iPad Pro.
Mm-hmm.
What were your thoughts?
He only got it yesterday and I got to see it for like 10 minutes or whatever, but you can get a decent read on what's changed because, as we just mentioned, all the changes are essentially superficial, right? They don't change how you use the product. So
yeah,
you can get a decent read on whether you think it's cool or not based on a very short amount of time. So if you're near an Apple store, I'd definitely go and check one out at a store because just think of an iPad and then you can see how much nicer it can be with this new 2024 generation. And it really is nice. Like the slenderness of it with the 5.1mm thinness, like, it's hard to say in speech, but like you hold it in your hand and it's like, this thing feels futuristic. Like it's just like, you know, it's almost just a pane of glass in your hand and it's so thin and it's so small and the weight is definitely impressive. I mean, it doesn't make it like float, right? It's still 550 grams of stuff, but he had the 2017 12.9-inch before that, so we were like holding them in either hand, and it definitely makes the weight, like the lighter weight, makes a significant difference. Now, the 2017 iPad Pro 13-inch was about 670 grams. I believe the 2018 was then only like 610 grams, so it actually got a lot lighter just the year after. And then the 2020 and 21, it suddenly got heavier again, especially when they added mini LED. So it kind of shot back up to about 670 grams. So basically the 2017 was about the same weight as the M2 one, right? And you can definitely feel the weight difference. Like if you hold it in portrait, like a book, the older 13-inch felt more like a diving board because the weight would make it sag out your hand. But the new one, it's like the weight, the 15% less weight, you can hold it in one hand a lot more comfortably. You're probably still mostly using it in landscape in your lap or whatever, but the times you are like carrying it around, I think you will notice the difference. And it is an impressive device to look at just with the thinness and the sleekness, and it feels really modern. So I was really taken by that. The screen, I would describe it as comparable to the mini LED display on the previous couple of generations, which have only been on the 12.9, right, before, except that you don't get the blooming. So if you're on a black background with white text, you don't see like the halo around the white text because there's no dimming zones. Each pixel is lit individually. So you get like perfect contrast in those situations. Otherwise, I think it's a bit more difficult to see the difference between the mini LED and the OLED. Not because it's bad, it's just like the mini LED was pretty good apart from the blooming issue. Now you don't have the blooming issue. The other thing that annoyed me about the mini LED was the response time when you change from like white to black.
Oh yeah.
That is better in some situations, but if you're going from black to black, you then get the classic OLED issue, right? Where you get the kind of like jelly scrolling look to it. This basically all the downsides of OLED that you see on your phone also apply here, which is mainly the you know, the chance of burning, but that's very slim. The kind of like dark jelly effect thing that only really happens if you're in like dark mode with like dark grays and you kind of like have a lot of motion, you can kind of see a bit of jiggling around. And the off-axis blue shift thing, which happens on the iPhone today, you just kind of get used to it. But if you like hold your iPhone straight towards you, it's like fine. But if you tilt it to the left or right, the whites turn slightly bluish. That same effect happens on the iPad too. And because the iPad is a bigger screen, you know, you're tilting it off axis more than not, right? Because the phone you look at straight dead on a lot more often. The iPad, you're a bit more off axis. You'll see the blue shift. Your brain quickly adjusts to it, but I definitely notice it. So it's still there. Otherwise, it's hard to fault the Tandem OLED thing. The thing with the mini LED is the blooming issue. And then secondly, the vignetting you get with the brightness at the corner of the screens. This annoys me on the MacBook Pro to this day. You like look in the top left or the top right of the screen, and it's just ever so slightly dimmer in the corners because, I don't know, there's just not the backlighting around there. So there's like a vignette effect of like a small border of darkness around the main screen. The OLED screen doesn't have that problem. So it looks almost perfect. Apart from the blooming's gone. Like it's hard to fault, but it's kind of like if you have a mini LED screen in normal conditions, are you just looking at like a photograph? It'd probably look about the same as the OLED. It's only when you've got like the situations where before you'd see the blooming artifacts that you could probably notice that the OLED's significantly better. So I think if you're upgrading from an 11-inch, it'll be more significant because you never had mini LED before. If you're upgrading from a mini LED model, which is like the last two generations in the 12.9, maybe it makes less of a difference. And then the M4 chip, I mean, I wouldn't know it had a faster chip in it if you didn't tell me, right? Because what were you doing with it? You're browsing the web and you're scrolling around, which is fast before too. So very happy with this generation. I think it's great, but it's not going to transform your iPad experience because it's still at the end of the day, an iPad, right? So just have that as well. Like if you've got a previous generation, I wouldn't feel the pressure to upgrade. If you're upgrading from 2017, I think it's a great update. 2018, probably a good update, especially if you've got the 11-inch, right? So you can either get the 11-inch or the 13-inch and get the much better screen. So that's kind of where I come down with it. And the weight and the thinness are significant, and you notice them, and it feels great in your hand. I personally wouldn't pay, you know, the four-digit prices just for those changes. It's just, oh, it's time to upgrade your iPad. It's also now thinner and lighter. So that'd be my rough takeaway from 10 minutes using my brother's last night.
The parity between the screens on the 11 and 13-inch models is one of the biggest stories of this generation. But in the reviews, one of the things that stood out to me most is the Magic Keyboard on the Surface doesn't seem as different as you would expect. I think last week I said the final product maybe wasn't as dramatic as I had thought based on Mark Gurman's reporting.
Mm-hmm.
But the reviews almost universally say this new Magic Keyboard is infinitely better than the old Magic Keyboard.
Yeah, my brother didn't buy a Magic Keyboard, so yeah. I can't speak to that in the hand. But the reviews definitely were like, this Magic Keyboard's great. But it's not that much different, right? Like, it's the same general style. They've just made it aluminium. It's a bit more stable because it doesn't have to tilt back as far because the iPad itself is lighter. And they made the trackpad better because it has, like, haptic click and stuff, and it has the feedback.
But the better trackpad seems to be the takeaway for a lot of people. That switch from the trackpad that physically moves to the haptic trackpad basically makes it, in a lot of ways, just like an iPad Air or like a MacBook Air. Like, looking at the keyboard, looking at the trackpad, at least on the 13-inch model, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any way the MacBook Air is better than the iPad Pro in that regard. And the praise for the Magic Keyboard is one of the reasons where I wasn't super tempted to upgrade, but now I kind of am, just because I do love the Magic Keyboard.
And and it's unfortunate that you can't get the new Magic Keyboard work with the M2 because the magnets are in different places. Yeah.
And when I use my 12.9-inch iPad Pro right now, I almost always use it in the Magic Keyboard. So a new Magic Keyboard would be a big upgrade for me. And the 13-inch iPad Pro itself is significantly thinner and lighter, so I'd be more inclined to use it occasionally outside of the Magic Keyboard, just as a tablet. But like you just said, it's still an iPad for all of its faults, and it's a four-figure price, especially when you factor in the Magic Keyboard, then it becomes a lot less tempting. It's like there were multiple times over the past 2 or 3 days since the reviews came out where I would see somebody's post on Instagram, see a video on YouTube, read a review, and I'd be like, okay, I want this thing. Then I'd go to the Apple Store app, build my cart, see the price, and be like, okay, maybe not. It's just one of those things where it's such a good product, but it's so expensive. It still runs iPadOS. It's hard, hard, hard to justify. So I don't know. I might pull the trigger at some point. I might not. We'll see. I know you think I shouldn't.
I think it's a bit wasteful to upgrade from the M2, like the previous generation version.
Yeah.
Especially if you've already got the mini LED screen. Because, yes, the OLED is better, but the brightness is the same. It's mostly just like taking the mini LED and removing the downsides of the blooming. It was my takeaway. I mean, the ProMotion, the response time is great. It's a great screen, but the mini LED one is not terrible. It's just the blooming with the big downside there, the number one downside, and that doesn't exist anymore. But is that really worth buying a whole new iPad, you know, that's from the most recent generation? I'm not so sure about that. And there's a lot of commentary where it's like, well, surely at WWDC they're going to make it way better and they're going to take advantage of the M4 chip and, you know, the neural engine. I'll see it when I believe it on that one. Like, I don't think that's how it goes. For better or for worse, if they had, like, super significant software changes, they would have rolled them out now. They would have had it ready for 17.4 or 17.5, right? Like they did when they did the Magic Keyboard originally and had all the pointer cursor stuff in that release. Whatever change they got for iPadOS 18 are going to be independent of the hardware roadmap in almost every case. Like, I would be shocked if there's one feature in iPadOS 18 that requires the M4 iPad Pro. I'd be gobsmacked. It just doesn't work that way. So I hope there's improvements to the iPad software stack. Wouldn't bet much on it that it's actually going to happen this year, because I think all of their resources and attention is on AI, which is great and will further the platform, it will further the iPhone, but it doesn't really address the specific issues of, you know, iPod productivity and multitasking and file management and all that jazz. But as an iPad, the iPad Pro is tempting. Even for all my commentary about it, like, I kind of want one. You know, like, you hold it in your hand, you're like,
yeah,
that thing is cool. And it, as an entertainment machine, you know, everything that you do with an iPad today, it is like a great form factor. It just feels so advanced. It feels like tablety, right? Less like computery, especially that 13-inch size, because before it was like so huge, and so heavy, and now it's like a lot better on those metrics.
My problem is I'm already tempted to buy it and I haven't even seen it or held it in person. So that's going to present a real problem for me. I'm going to go to maybe Best Buy tomorrow and see if they have them on display. And if not, I'll be near an Apple store over the weekend, and I'll check them out there.
Isn't your Apple Store going on strike or something?
Yes, the Maryland Apple Store is going on strike, but I leave on Saturday to drive a very scenic route to Baltimore. So I'm going up through Colorado and up through Wyoming, and I'll pass a few Apple Stores along the way. And my prediction of how it goes is I'm going to stop at the Apple Store in Colorado Springs either Sunday or Monday, and I'm going to love it, but I'm not going to buy it. And then a few days later, I'll be passing through another Apple Store, and I'll say,
"You're going to cave."
All right, well, maybe it's worth it.
I would say my recommendation would be hold, you know, resist the temptation. Go and see it. You'll get it out of your system, you know.
Yeah.
Then wait till June, right? See if iPadOS 18 has exclusive stuff or even just makes it better overall. Then it feels like a more justified upgrade. But otherwise, I feel like it's going to be one of those things where, especially if you use your iPad in a case, you know, then a lot of the thickness improvements get disappeared and mitigated immediately.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like if you're upgrading from the iPhone 14 to the iPhone 15, but the cameras didn't change, you know, like mm-hmm. It's nice and it's clearly better and it's got titanium and all that jazz, but it's still an iPhone that works the same, you know? So when these things were like, when the iPad was $499, that kind of range, it was a lot more tempting to upgrade on a more regular basis. But when you're spending, you know, $1,200 for 13-inch plus $300 for the Magic Keyboard plus taxes plus everything else, like, it's going to be a $2,000 investment for the same product that you hold in your hands right now, essentially, right? So just keep that in your head, I would say. But that is not a criticism of this generation of iPad. It is stunning that they managed to fit all that in something that's thin and that's thin and light.
The last thing on the iPad Pro is, we've been saying iPadOS is still limiting in a lot of different ways. Federico Viticci didn't get an iPad Pro review in it, so instead he published this breakdown of like all of the different ways iPadOS is still limited, it still affects his workflow, and I'll put that link in the show notes. But for we just keep saying that iPadOS is still limited. You know, it's a great iPad Pro, but it's still iPadOS, and this is a good breakdown of what exactly we mean when we say that, because a lot of my thoughts align pretty much perfectly with Federico, so I'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, he outlines like 7 or 8 bullet points that are like dead on. If you gave me a long enough conversation, I could probably think of 100 more of just like small little, because it's like death by a thousand cut scenarios, yeah. Right? But that is a good start where, like, if they addressed 8 of those things, a lot more people would shut up about the software situation. Finally, this week, Happy Hour is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. And that's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs is the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. As you're growing your team, it's so important to have high quality candidates to interview so you know you're ultimately hiring the best person for the job. And LinkedIn makes it so easy to find them. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It is ubiquitous and the place you want to be for your job to be seen, with a vast network of more than 1 billion professionals. I know, for instance, when my brother was looking for work last year, LinkedIn is the first place he went to find a job. LinkedIn gives you access to professionals that you can't find anywhere else. In fact, in a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you aren't looking on LinkedIn, you are looking in the wrong place and possibly missing people altogether. Hiring is easy when you have that many quality candidates available. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate through LinkedIn within 24 hours. LinkedIn is constantly working to make their hiring platform even better. They recently just launched a feature to help you write job descriptions, which makes the process even quicker. So join 2.5 million small businesses that use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/happyhour. That's linkedin.com/happyhour to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring the show.
So we've referenced the new AI things coming a few times already through this episode, and now we have a bit of an update. So new reporting from the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg, both of whom say that Apple is planning to develop or already developing its own AI cloud servers, cloud chips, whatever you want to call them, powered right now by the M2 Ultra and soon the M4 chips. Mark Gurman says that Apple's focus is still on running as many of the simpler AI-related features directly on device, but Apple using its own custom silicon in these servers is, at least my interpretation is, perhaps most importantly, it's a big cost savings for them because those cloud computing servers for AI features are one of the most expensive aspects of offering cloud-based features.
It isn't clear to me, like, and I don't think it's clear to anyone yet, exactly what they'll be running on their own servers.
Right.
Because you're basically going to have like a three-tiered approach where you have a lot of it running on device, right? Obviously using your local smarts. They're obviously running M2 Ultra and M4 chips to do something in the cloud through Apple's infrastructure. And then they're also doing the licensing deal with OpenAI, who Bloomberg also in the past week said Apple's finalized the deal with OpenAI to license ChatGPT. And they maybe are also going to sign Google Gemini deal. That's up in the air still. So somewhere between the full chatbot thing, which is obviously what GPT and Gemini are for, and all the stuff you're doing locally on your phone, that's where their servers are going to come in. But we don't quite know yet exactly what that means, like what specific AI tasks are going to be running, not on device, but on the server. It seems like the GPT stuff, the ChatGPT license, is for the chatbot experience. But even that is, the lines are a bit blurry, because like, if you're talking to Siri and you're like, Siri, set a timer, blah, 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 okay, it sets a timer. And then it's like, you know, Siri, tell me what the weather's going to do next week. Like, you could have obviously it can answer that today, but you could also answer that with a chatbot and get more variation in your responses, or get a different description of the week ahead and the forecast. So like, it's still a bit murky exactly what is going to be delineated and how. And I think if Apple pulls it off correctly, it will all be transparent, right? So the user shouldn't have to know or be aware or have to like phrase right. their request differently based on where the thing is heading. Like, because obviously the on-device model is going to be less powerful and dumber than what can run on servers, because it's just a fact of memory, if not CPU power. So ideally, in the best scenario, Apple programs this so you can ask whatever you want, and then it shuttles it off to the right place to get the job done. But that also is hard to reconcile with their like privacy,
you know,
data security approach, because you can't like, you, if you ask something slightly more complicated and it gets shuttled off to their cloud servers, they don't have access to your data, especially if you have like advanced data protection turned on iCloud, right? Because then everything's end to end and it's only on your device anyway in a decrypted form. So it'll be interesting to see how it exactly plays out. And I hope it's done nicely and integrated and smoothly and transparently, but maybe it won't be, and then it'll be slightly more disappointing. Like, it's hard to draw any conclusion right now until we actually see how it's done. But I'm like struggling to think like what is complicated enough that it is going to be run on Apple's server infrastructure, but not so complicated that it requires the ChatGPT smarts. You know what I mean? Like, what's the in-between position? I'm not 100% sure. Maybe it's like image generation kind of tasks. Don't know yet. Because obviously stuff like where it's going to be like quick replies or summarizing of your message and notifications, there's no way they're going to let like leave your phone. That's all going to be on device and could well be achieved. It's kind of like the Siri stuff where it becomes more murky, because, you know, Siri is the feature, but there's so much stuff you could do under, you know, a voice assistant kind of phrasing. And I hope we don't get to a point where like you accidentally ask a request that get sent to the ChatGPT side, but the ChatGPT side doesn't know about your personal information, so it can't do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, ideally, these things can kind of like work cohesively together and, you know, communicate back and forth and pass data off as necessary. And maybe if you like ask something that is particularly sensitive, but it requires the Apple cloud or the, you know, the OpenAI cloud, that it may be like prompts you. It's like, this information here is going to be sent to our servers. Are you okay with this? Or maybe there's like a permissions system or something like that. So it does work nice and transparently, because what you're going to be competing against is the Google and OpenAI systems, which don't care about your privacy at all, right. But they'll probably work more smoothly, or at least in theory, they can work more smoothly because they can just ingest everything. So Apple has to approach this smartly, right? Like, it's not an easy task. You can say it's easy to just do it on device, but it's more complicated when you dive into the detail.
Because it's the question we've been asking all along, is how much will Apple be willing to compromise its privacy and standards and end-to-end encryption for the sake of having a robust set of AI features to please users who want those AI features, and also investors in the broader world saying that Apple is behind on AI.
And they're obviously willing to compromise something because they're building out their own cloud infrastructure. And they'll make it as private as possible, but if you're running AI stuff in a cloud, it's going to be, by definition, less private than if it was running on your phone, you know?
So I think it would be incredibly disappointing to see Apple roll out this suite of features without some sort of protection, without some sort of privacy focus for everything in place. That would suggest to me that privacy and security is an argument they can use when it's convenient for them or in their hands to control all of it, but they're willing to toss it out the window if it means they can offer a chatbot.
Yeah, maybe it's not like tossed out the window, but maybe it's like here's a second screen where you can choose. And it's like, do you want everything to run on device or are you okay with your data being used in the cloud and you have to like opt in? That kind of feels like an approach Apple might do where they admit that to do all the stuff they want to do, they do need to relax the privacy slightly, but they're not going to do it without like your explicit consent. That's kind of maybe where they'll end up.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll find out in not very long now.
The other AI things this week, you kind of touched on them, but Bloomberg says that Apple is finalizing a deal with OpenAI to bring ChatGPT features to iOS 18. And the New York Times says that generative AI-powered Siri is set to be announced at WWDC. You touched on most of that. All of it's kind of expected. Bloomberg does say that a deal with Google Gemini is not out of the question, but right now Apple's closing in on that agreement with OpenAI.
The MIT story was significant, I think, because everybody assumes that, you know, if they're doing AI-related stuff, that includes Siri, but it's not a guarantee, right? Like, yeah. They could have done all AI predict, you know, proactive features on iOS and done like message notification summaries and auto replies, and Siri could have carried on unchanged for another year or something. But the MIT report was like, no, there is going to be generative AI powered Siri announced at WWDC following like Craig Federighi and John Gianandre making a big stink about it at the beginning of last year internally when they were trying out ChatGPT stuff and came away really impressed. And they're like, we need to invest in Siri now to at least be more competitive than it is. And so apparently that's ready for a WWDC debut, which will be fantastic. Again, there's big questions, like if it's going to be a lot of it powered on device, what about devices that aren't very powerful?
Yes.
You know, like HomePods or the Apple Watch, for instance, or just even older iPhones and stuff. Like, that's unclear. It's also interesting to think about whether the OpenAI chatbot licensing will be even like branded as Siri or not. Or maybe it's like altogether separate. Like, that's one way they could sidestep the privacy question.
Yeah.
There is like, well, if you're using Siri, that's only using our on-device stuff on our cloud. But maybe you have to go into like the Messages app and you like talk to the chatbot or something if you want to do the OpenAI thing. Like,
there's a world in which it's possible that this deal with OpenAI is literally just going to, in some form or fashion, bring or have the ChatGPT app be pre-installed or in iOS 18.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be like a foundational part of the Siri experience or anything.
The first iPhone had YouTube pre-installed, so I guess there's some precedent.
Yeah, and I did like the NYT quote, which is like, the generative AI Siri will focus on improving performance of tasks it already does, like setting timers, rather than writing poetry. So, like, you know, which is perfectly like a good position, because there's a lot of focus on like ChatGPT and stuff where you get it to like, you know, make jokes or make rhyming couplets or do like dumb stuff, which is a novelty, but it's like impressive. But day to day, you just want like the things you want your voice assistant to do. You just want them to do really well. And what we've seen in the not too distant past, like with the rabbit thing or the humane thing, is that they could answer, you know, these really esoteric trivia questions, but they couldn't at all set a timer. You know, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's been this big gulf here. And even with like Google Assistant, like in the transition from Google Assistant to Gemini and Android, they've like lost functionality that was actually useful to people. Like certain ways you can interact with your like smart home stuff has like been lost to the fire because they've moved forward. So I hope whatever Apple does can preserve, you know, the bits of Siri that actually do work well, and make those bits even better still. Like, I think a great use of this generative AI backend would be to just remove the times when I'm doing like a smart home request and Siri gets confused about what I say, because it's like, you know, if I say turn on this in this room and this in this room, it tries to look for a device that's specifically called this and this rather than understanding that I'm asking for two different things. Like, that's a situation where an LLM, whether it's on device or not, is really good at parsing out language, and they could enhance the smart home control that you can already do. Like, I'm less interested in, to use the MIT phrase, write poetry with it. So we will see not too long. I know it's what, like 3 weeks now until WWDC.
And when
this kind of stuff came out last year, that Apple was like flat-footed and like rushing to introduce AI stuff, I thought we'd be getting around to May 2024 and we'd be getting all the stories like, this is delayed, this has been punted to another year, but there hasn't really been much of that. It seems like they've got a fair amount of stuff, of concrete stuff, ready to go.
All right, I think that does it for this week. As always, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a rating and a review to help more people find the show. You can send us feedback, happyhour@9to5mac.com. Find an ad-free version of the show with bonus content, 9to5mac.com/join. I'm on Threads, Twitter, Mastodon, @ChanceHMiller. And Mayo, what about you?
@BZAMayo.
All right, thanks, Mayo.
Bye-bye.